right. Good morning, everybody. Today is Friday. Yay, it's Friday, December 15th, 2017. And this is Before the First Cup with Jules here on UCY.TV. Happy Friday, everyone. It is a brisk 15 degrees with a real feel of 3 and cloudy here in upstate New York. So where do we leave off yesterday? We ran an interview by Nikola Danilov, and he was interviewing MIT neuroscientist Dr. Ed Boyden. Now, who is Dr. Ed Boyden? We're going to take a little bit of a look at that today and kind of tie this in to what we have been discussing over the last few weeks. We have spent a lot of time looking at the brain and ways to manipulate the brain with one of the primarily non-invasive ways would be with some sort of flash of light or some sort of electrical or electromagnetic spectrum, such as microwave. We looked at Cuba and some of the things that were happening to our, I don't have to remember what they call them. I was going to call them emissaries, but you know, people in the embassy, the emissarians. And there was actually some damage done to their white matter. So Dr. Ed Boyden, this MIT neuroscientist, let's take a look at who he really is. I thought this was interesting. While the interview was running, did a couple searches on him, and I found a really strange story. They had had a competition that was financed by a lot of the tech billionaires for breakthrough prizes that would give top scientists all kinds of money to further their research. This story is out of the New York Times, November 8th, 2015. Breakthrough Prize gives top scientists the rock star treatment. The richest awards in science were handed out Sunday night when the Breakthrough Prize organization presented a total of $21.9 million to physicists, mathematicians, life scientists, as well as one talented high school student. The award takes the form of seven $3 million awards, which was evenly split among the 1,300 physicists, $500,000 split among eight early career researchers, $400,000 to a high school student for creating a video communicating a scientific concept. Well, that's quite a take. The breakthrough prizes were founded by Sergey Brin of Google and his ex-wife, Ann Wojcicki of 23andMe, Jack Ma of Alibaba and his wife, Kathy Zhang, Yuri Milner, an internet entrepreneur, and his wife, Julia Milner, as well as Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook and his wife, Priscilla Chan. The awards were given out in an Oscar-style ceremony hosted by the founders of Graydon Carter, the Vanity Fair editor, at NASA's Ames Research Center in Mountain View, California, with entertainment by Pharrell Williams and food by Thomas Keller, blah, 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 blah. The scientists were in their Oscar-worthy finest, and it shows them all standing up front, winning some sort of, like, trophy, and they're all in their black suits. And it began when Mr. Milner announced in 2012 that he would hand out $3 million apiece to nine theoretical physicists in belief that physicists are equal to the rock stars and deserve to be paid and celebrated like them. Over the years, as more sponsors have joined, the prizes have spread to life sciences as well as mathematics, and the winners each year are chosen by a committee of previous winners. The challenging conventional thinking and expanding knowledge over the long term, scientists can solve the biggest problems of our time, says Zuckerberg. These breakthrough prizes honor achievements in science and math, and so we can encourage more pioneering research and celebrate scientists as the heroes they truly are. Remember, we read about the gene drive files a couple days ago, where we discovered that DARPA was one of the biggest funders into researching gene drives as some sort of biowarfare component and how to cure it. And Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and one of their organizations that they supported was responsible for, I think it was like $1.6 million in trying to sway the UN to vote for gene drives. Well, here's this year's Breakthrough Prize laureates. Number one happens to be Carl Deseroth and Dr. Edward S. Boyden, the very one from yesterday. Carl Deseroth, who is a professor at Stanford University and a Howard Hughes Medical Institute investigator, as well as Edward S. Boyden, a professor at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, has received $3 million for their roles in the development of optogenetics, which is a technique that allows scientists to use light to turn neurons and groups of neurons on and off, like flipping a light switch. The technique is transforming the study of the brain because it allows scientists to test ideas out about how the brain works and has already been used to turn a kind of aggression on and off in flies and then thirst on and off in mice. And they also turn the aggression on and off in mice, we discovered just recently, pinpointing the brain cells involved. The technique is universally praised, but the question of who will be recognized for its development is an issue for any prize committee. Dr. Boyden, Dr. Deseroth, and three other scientists published a paper in 2005 that is recognized as the breakthrough. They demonstrated how to reliably control mammalian neurons with light, making widespread use of the technique inevitable. Coming to a doctor's office near you someday, or maybe to your monitor. We're going to look at some of that a little bit later. Their paper is built on earlier work, as much science does, and opsins, which are the light-sensitive chemicals that are crucial to optogenetics, have been studied since the 1970s. The fact that optogenetics could be done was demonstrated back in 2002, and in 2013, the European Brain Prize recognized six scientists for work on optogenetics, including Dr. Boyden and Dr. Deseroth. So there you have it. He was one of the founders of optogenetics. It was strange he didn't talk a lot about it. He talked a little bit of a segment on it. But he was quite into being able to manipulate and control neurons and find ways, of course, to cure diseases. That's what it's all about, curing disease. Step right up for your little flashes of light. So now talking about reprogramming the brain. Over the last few days, we had read some stories about former Facebook executives, and there was two of them. Sean Parker was one, and the guy's name who I can't say. Hold on, let me scroll down. Chamath Palihapitiya, who's a former vice president of user growth. They have both pointed out how we are being programmed. They're using feedback loops with thumbs up, thumbs down, to program the public to want that dopamine carrot to be able to validate or unvalidate things, and that is ripping apart society. Well, now we're going to take a look at something else because there was a news story. Facebook then responds to damning criticism from former executive. And you always got to love a geeky picture of Zuckerberg on the front. So speaking about Zuckerberg, the social network says it was a very different company back then when they were manipulating your brain chemicals. Facebook has issued a response to comments made by a former executive who said the platform and other social networks are destroying how society works. Mark Zuckerberg's firm didn't deny that Chamath Palihapitiya's claim, but stressed that it was now a very different company when he worked there. Speaking at Stanford's Graduate School of Business last month, the one-time vice president of user growth at Facebook said he felt tremendous guilt for his role in helping the site become what it is today. He added that the company's early employees kind of knew that they were building something that could be abused, but they ignored their instincts. That short-term dopamine-driven feedback loop that we've created is destroying how society works. No civil discourse, no cooperation, misinformation, and mistruth, says Palihapitiya. Instead of refuting the statement, Facebook is highlighting the fact that Palihapitiya hasn't worked at the company for over 6 years. So we're not doing that anymore. Shh, go back to sleep. And when Chamath was at Facebook, we were focusing on building new social media experiences and growing Facebook around the world. We wanted to assimilate you. Facebook was a very different company back then. And as we have grown, we have realized that our responsibilities have grown too, said the company. Palihapitiya did backtrack slightly in an interview on CNBC yesterday, and he explained that his comments were directed at social media in general rather than being an attack on just Facebook. What I am talking about was the question that what you do think the long-term effects of social media in general are. Unfortunately, when what happened was, I think it is easy to characterize what I said just as Facebook-specific things, because I work there, he says. But Palihapitiya isn't the only former Facebook executive to criticize the company. Ding! Sean Parker, The firm's first president also warned of the detrimental effects of social media on society and how it exploits vulnerabilities in the human psychology. Quote, he says, God only knows what it is doing to our children's brain. And that's what I've been saying all along. This dopamine dangling carrot is something that I'm living with right now on a daily basis since the school gave all of the kids this year notebooks to do their homework on and to bring home, but didn't put any type of parental controls to block sites. You know, we have the right out of school, get on the notebook because I have homework to do. We set a time deadline of 8 o'clock, whether you're done or not, and every night at 8 o'clock, it's like, oh, wait, I have one more thing to do. And that continues on till about 10, and it always turns into an argument. It's been causing a lot of stress in my life here. So here's Facebook's full statement, if we really care. And I guess I'll read it just to finish the article. Chamath has not been at Facebook for over 6 years, and when Chamath was at Facebook, we were focused on building a new social media experience and growing Facebook around the world. Facebook was a very different company back then. We've grown to realize our responsibilities have grown too, and that's where they quoted before. We take our role very seriously, and we're working hard to improve. My name is Mark Zuckerberg, and we've done a lot of work and research with outside experts and academics to understand the effects of our service on well-being. Yeah, just like we're going to have you mind typing here in the future with Regina Duggan's project. We are using it to inform our product development. We are also making significant investment in people, technology, and processes. And as Zuckerberg said on the last earnings call, we are willing to reduce our profitability. Oh, I'm sure the shareholders didn't like that one. To make sure right investments are being made. Well, how awesome is that? So now let's talk about feedback loops, because I was thinking about negative feedback loops a couple days ago. I don't know what day that was, a few days back. I did a show, and I don't know, I was having a real hard time finding stories to connect together that made any type of good show for you guys. But you know me, I tend to try to go on live if I can, and if not, I try to put at least an interesting lecture or speech on for you to listen to that ties into the things we've been doing. But I was having a lot of trouble, but I came on anyway, froze my ass off out here. And I didn't think it was a great show, but I didn't think it was a bad show. And I got two thumbs down on YouTube on the archive that day. And, you know, people say it's haters. Maybe it's haters. Maybe it's just obnoxious people that go out there and go, you know what? You didn't make me laugh today or something. Or, you know what? That wasn't as interesting as it normally is. And give me a thumbs down. But I got to tell you, that definitely affects my motivation to want to feel like putting myself out tomorrow to do all the research to be able to put on another show. So that would be considered a negative feedback loop. And it's funny because this morning I was trying to think of what I was going to talk about today. And my husband said it at the very same time. He's like, hey, why don't you look into thumbs down as brainwashing? So this is what I came up with. The science behind stress and anxiety, two things that I have too much of in my life. The ancient brain. And this is out of a website, ancientbrain.net, from November 12, 2013. Why we exhaust ourselves. Today, people tend to be overwhelmed not just by constant inputs technologically, but by self-criticism. First, the brain is actually built to focus on the negative and is an evolutionary vestige built for survival. But today, neuroscientists are aware that it isn't just an annoyance, that the brain remembers and focuses on the negative much more readily than it does on the positive. The brain not only retains more negative memories for longer periods of time, but components of the brain actually work to prevent positive experiences from being retained, and that would all be in the name of survival. This was perfect and well and good when we are being hunted by large prey animals like a cheetah or fighting off rival tribes and memorizing and maximizing awareness to potential threats in life. And death was a proposition for all creatures, including walking bipeds. Today, however, this focus on the negative is much less of a purpose, and in fact has proven that negativity creates many of our physical problems. And, you know, all my issues here with blood pressure and circulation in that. Last thing I need is cortisol coursing through my veins because of stress and anxiety. So more on this later, but for now, suffice it to say that the brain treats positive thoughts and experiences like Teflon, but treats negative experiences like Velcro. And that's very true, but listen to this. Animals do not have this problem. When an antelope narrowly escapes an attack by a predator, it very quickly shakes off that trauma and goes back to grazing or doing whatever it was doing before the attack. And that is because it doesn't have a more modern, complex thinking brain. It resolves the trauma and the stress very quickly and naturally. Animals don't dwell on their anxiety and fear because they don't have the capability to do so. And when an animal has a traumatic experience, it has mechanisms in place that quickly resolve it so it can go back to eating and procreating as well as whatever else it wants to do. Now, if you think to some of our experiences in everyday life, we experience a lot of traumatic things every day. And if for nothing else in our lives, how about on the news? You know, they've found negative is a way to control the population. I thought there was a story one time, and I don't have it up here, but let me just paraphrase, that it looked at how neuroscientists had discovered that with fear and anxiety, they could turn a population into a more right-winged leaning population that, of course, was all calling for the need for security. Now, how interesting is that, especially considering the way things have been going since 2001? So, unfortunately, we modern humans are not so lucky, especially when it comes to conceptual or imagined threats that trigger anxiety, stress, and panic. Everyone has experienced at some point or another, but for some, these states last weeks, months, and in some cases even years with dire results, as was the case with this poor veteran they're going to talk about. This is probably going to be PTSD, something that they will be able to zippity-zap and fix one day. One of the reasons that humans enter into negative feedback loops is because their more evolved brains try to figure out solutions to their fears, real or imagined. And when they can't, using their newer cortex capabilities, it causes more stress, which the brain then uses to trigger alarms that the body is under attack, and the cycle continues. To avoid going into brain geek speak, which we do a lot on the show, let's describe what the brain does in response to an apparent threat in simple terms. According to Williams and Penman, when humans are stressed or feel threatened, our fight or flight reactions kick in, driven by one of the more ancient parts of the brain, which would be the amygdala. I can never say that. Amygdala. The symptoms of this can be increased heart rate, profuse sweating, tremors, nausea, panic, increased breathing, dizziness, and so on, all in the name of preparing the body for defending itself or for fleeing. There's another response called freezing, but that will be addressed at another point. This reaction, in turn, switches on what Williams and Penman refer to as the doing mode, where the brain searches for answers for dealing with the threats. And when your newer, more evolved brain functions try to figure out how to solve that problem, it's searching its memory database for past information to solve the problem or threat. But it's thinking about possible future outcomes usually is in a negative way. And when this part of the brain can't solve the problem, then the individual dwells or obsesses on the threat, and the brain doesn't resolve it as it does with the antelope. It can instead begin a negative feedback loop where the fight or flight symptoms become exacerbated or worsen. Now, thinking about that in regards to me doing this show, there's always this threat of the coming dystopia. And I don't have a solution for it. So the next section, called Danger Will Robinson, the negative feedback loop. The brain's alarm systems triggered with initial stressors or threats say switched on because the ancient processor doesn't care whether the threat is real or you are just being unreasonably obsessive. All it knows is it's danger, Danger Will Robinson. Well, why is this a problem? Well, this well, your body and your brain really start to react together and protect you from the threat. But the thing is, you really don't necessarily need protecting, but it doesn't matter. The ancient brain says that you do, so it acts accordingly. But what happens next is it can be pretty frightening, and it is what many of us all call post-traumatic stress disorder. To paraphrase Williams, unlike the running antelope, we don't stop to eat grass after the danger has passed. We keep on running. The modern brain, or doing mode, views unhappiness, anxiety, stress, fear, minor illness as problems to be solved. And when the brain can't solve them, it creates more stress, feeding the ancient brain with fuel for protecting the organism, which happens to be you. Even though most of the time you don't really need protecting from anything real, the agnostic, indifferent ancient brain doesn't know or care about that. It is preparing you for battle or for flight, whether or not you need it. I don't know, as you want to keep going on. And there's a whole thing about negative feedback loops and mental hygiene. And then maybe we can rewire my brain. Well, yes, thank you. It is not a bad science fiction movie. The latest research proves that you can very much impact the way your brain is wired with pre-programming itself. The amazing thing about mindfulness, appreciation, and repeated positive inputs is that they literally help disrupt the negative feedback loop. So let's all be positive and create new neuron networks that actually make you feel better. Did you know, for example, the London cab drivers who have to memorize a dizzying labyrinth maze of streets have larger areas in their brains where spatial memory is stored? And this is very good news indeed, because your brain every day is rewiring itself, whether or not you know it. One leading expert on neuropsychology and on how the brain is programmed is Rick Hansen, the author of Hardwiring Happiness, The New Science of Contentment, Calm, and Confidence. We're all going to be rewired someday remotely. Hansen's book explains that for survival purposes, the brain has evolved to retain more negative information than and less positive ones. And in spite of the uphill battle to retain positive experiences, Hansen explains that we can, through practice, create new positive neural networks, basically an ability to quote-unquote program our brains for happiness. I don't know if I could live like that. According to Hansen, it is not enough to engage in mindfulness per se. One must really engage the positive experiences that we have so that the brain can ingrain them in a rushing stream of waters, like it creates deeper and deeper pathways in a riverbed. No easy task, but over time, practicing the ideas that Hansen offers will help create a more positive connection in the brain that can lead to a happier, healthier you. Here's a paper on it. I might link to that on the subject from Hansen that's well worth the read. And there are many other resources and recommendations that we'll be including later in the story somewhere, blah, blah, blah. So there you have it. So if you think positive, you will be happier and healthier. And we've talked a lot about the brain-body connection. And that's one of the reasons why, once they can get inside of our brain and they can start manipulating things, it's one of the reasons why we have to be careful. Somewhere in one of these stories, and I didn't quite get to it, I don't know where that was, about Boyden, he actually talked about some of their research. I might have to go back there. He talked about some of the research that they were doing with the retina. Ed Boyden has won a $3 million prize for peering into the brain, and here is how he's planning on spending it. And I kind of skipped over this one, but I didn't mean to. Neuroscience hasn't been the same since Ed Boyden arrived on the scene. And as a trainee at Stanford, Boyden helped develop a technique that allows scientists to control brain activity with light with exquisite precision. But back when he was looking for a faculty position, the young scientist could not land a job. Boyden eventually found a home at MIT Media Lab, where his blend of brain science and engineering was embraced. And in November of 2015, he won a $3 million breakthrough prize, which was funded by a lot of the tech entrepreneurs, an award started and funded by dot-com billionaires to celebrate scientific achievement. He recently met with Stat, because this is out of statnews.com, reporters and editors, and what follows are edited excerpts from his conversation. Now 36 and head of MIT Media Lab Synthetic Neurobiology Group. Dang, and I linked to that website in the notes of the show yesterday. Boyden spoke about how he and his wife, Boston University brain scientist Zhu Han, are spending the breakthrough prize money and how he keeps track of all of his ideas and how technology that he has had a hand in developing, including optogenetics and expansion microscopy, which could move from a research tool to helping patients and being used on you. My wife and I have been discussing lots of things. When they asked, what are you doing with the $3 million? Part of it is what we are using to try to support research that's too crazy to get funded by normal means. Ding, ding. Could we make an optimal way of prospecting for treasure in the natural world, or could we find unknown things that could have revolutionary diagnostic, therapeutic, or scientific impact? If you look at a lot of great biotechnologies, they often are stumbled across from curiosity, like wondering why a jellyfish glows green or looking for enzymes in a hot spring, all sorts of stuff. That stuff in peer-reviewed settings don't often sound cool. Who wants to look at a jellyfish all day? Are you spending any money of on yourself? Well, certainly my wife and I are putting some of it aside for our kids' college education. But I spend most of my time in the lab working or at my desk thinking, and everything is either thinking science or taking care of the kids at this point. That's what my life is pretty much. And the network. And how do you spend your day, they ask? He says, well, I tend to get up really early, like around 4 or 5 in the morning, like I do too, so I can get a couple hours of thinking done, because you know what? When it is quiet is the only time I really can get thinking done. Otherwise, I feel like my brain is short-circuiting. And then most of the day is spent working with students and postdocs on reviewing projects, thinking of ideas, analyzing data, writing manuscripts, and so forth. Then I try to go to bed early at 8 or 9, so do I. And it actually has helped a lot instead of staying up all night. And at the same time as the kids do, and my wife has the opposite schedule. She stays up late, and that's when she gets her stuff done. So occasionally we get to see each other. I'll tell you what, that staying up late really did a number on my brain. I had read a couple studies about how not getting enough sleep actually causes your brain not to get rid of a lot of the waste that it produces during the day when it's trying to sort through things that you've learned. And it's not a good thing to deprive yourself. Are you and your wife constantly nerding out on the stuff, they asked? Well, we really talk about science. Do we really care? In part because we collaborated a lot in the past. She was one of the key players in optogenetic neural silencing. Oh, it's his wife. And occasionally I do start talking about some topic and try to learn more about it. And she's like, oh, we published a paper on that about a year ago. Optogenetics has allowed scientists to control selectivity with light by introducing light-sensitive genes from algae or bacteria into living cells. It has mostly been used in research settings, but the first human clinical trials using the tool, which is aiming to treat disease that causes blindness, is underway, and we talked about that in our story. What do you think about optogenetics as a therapeutic? And he says, we have picked the retina to work on, which I think is an appropriate first step, since we know a lot about the retina, and the retina is light sensitive, I will add. We don't know enough about the brain, and we don't even have a list of cell types in the human brain, and using optogenetics, which is a cell type specific strategy, really does require some knowledge of the circuitry. Do you see any applications outside of the eye in the next 10 years, they ask? Well, there is no FDA approved gene therapy right now, but there are a lot of FDA approved cellular therapies. Imagine if we could deliver a cell into the body, and when you trigger it with light, it releases a hormone or a growth factor of some kind of biologic. And then you can make that cell, and you engineered it, so you could also put a kill switch in if you wanted. This could potentially be an avenue to a wide variety of ultra-precise control over bodily function. Now, guys, now that sentence right there, when we listened to his interview yesterday, and he was talking a lot about controlling different things, and then Nicola asked about free will and whether or not he believed in free will. And that was a kicker there for questioning. Because remember, free will allows you to do something whether or not it is demanded by biology. Can you still make that decision on your own? And the question is still kind of out there. I don't even remember what Dr. Boyden's answer was to that. I think he thought that maybe you didn't have free will. I don't remember, though. A couple of years ago, we started thinking about how we could really map the brain. So he's involved in this project as well. This is not a new quest, but the methods from prior attempts have often proven to be difficult to scale up to large 3D natures of brain circuits. So we started thinking, why don't we just do the opposite? Let's actually take a brain, one that was preserved, of course, and physically swell it up and make it bigger, and then move the molecules apart from each other to the point where we can tell them apart. Now, this is the first time I've ever heard about this horrifying thing. Let's swell the brain up with a polymer, and they're going to talk about that. Pretty rapidly, we were able to invent a method to do it. What we do is we take a sample of brain, and we wash it in building blocks that were once they were varied evenly throughout the tissue. Then we trigger them to form polymer chains, and the polymers are very similar chemically, almost identical to the swellable polymers that exist in a baby's diaper. If you add water, the polymers swell, and as millions of kids prove every day. And then as it swells, and that would be the brain tissue, it takes the molecules of the brain tissue with it to the point where you can move them far enough apart so that you can distinguish them. Now we're applying it to all sorts of stuff, to bacteria, cancer, biopsies, and virology questions. And there is a huge pent-up demand for ways of seeing large objects with nanoscale precision. Are there foreseeable applications in medicine? Well, one dream that has emerged is I take a sample from a patient and you can physically expand it for a small amount of money and then take a picture with a cheap piece of optics. I'm going to look at some of these brand new HD tiny cameras the size of a grain of sand here in a little bit if I ever get there. Could this be a way of revolutionizing the ability to analyze clinical samples with shape of information and all sorts of other information that you get lost if you do, say, just genome sequencing? Well, what do you read? Well, I kind of got obsessed in recent years with reading very old papers from the 50s to the 70s, and this is very important. We've been finding in our research as well, as you start digging back into some of these technologies, and we looked way back into Bell Labs and some of their developments in utilizing waves and different frequencies and some of the beaming technologies that they were using, microwaves back in Russia with the embassy, targeting employees and things of that nature. And there was a lot of research with cellular and brain manipulation going on way back when that we didn't even realize all in the name of the Cold War. There was a lot of old treasure in the scientific literature, and they worked on a project, and then they hit a brick wall in 1965. But you know what? Nowadays, with genome sequencing and better computers and so forth, that is the seed of an idea that could be transformative, right? Because with technology, we could do just about anything. Well, how do you keep track of all of the ideas buzzing around in your head? I've always been a compulsive note taker, and you know, that is something I used to do a lot of. I always had stacks of notebooks here on my desk, but I don't do that much anymore. I am having conversations or running meetings. I'm scribbling a piece of paper constantly, and then every couple of weeks, I go back and mine all of those conversation summaries, which you will have an AI to do at some point in the future. We talked about a few weeks ago, and as I call them, to see if I can notice things that I didn't notice at the time, or refresh my memory, or try to look at them from a different point of view. I also try to come up with ways to slow down and think about problems from different angles, and I think that is important. There's a huge push to do things quickly, but after I got tenure at MIT, my group members made a bunch of post-it notes with things that apparently I say all the time, and one of them was, follow the principle of applied laziness, which is sometimes if you're doing a lot of work to be busy, and that isn't necessarily the right thing to do when you could be thinking of a better idea that has a more transformative power, like finding ways to manipulate the brain neurons. So, all right, where do we go? So we found out about Facebook. We read about Mark Zuckerberg's response to that. Then we found out about the science of negative feedback loops. Of course, our brain puts us into that flight or fight mode, regardless of whether or not our brain needs it, which then has all kinds of physiological damaging effects on your blood pressure, I would say your circulatory system, potentially even how you think or how you react to things. So now a story came out of sciencemag.org. This is a research publication, December 14th, 2017. I've talked about being out of sync a lot of times and feeling like I've been exposed to an out-of-tune tuba. out of sync brainwaves may explain why we get forgetful as we age. And I think it is also explaining why we get forgetful when we are distracted frequently, which our devices do to us all the time. Our brains do not rest when we sleep. Electrical waves ripple through our noggins as our neurons talk to each other. And now researchers have shown that when these waves don't interact properly, we start to lose our long-term memory. The work may explain why older adults are getting so forgetful, and it could lead to new therapies to treat memory loss. To find out how sleep contributes to memory loss in old age, Randolph Heffleck, a neuroscientist at the University of California, Berkeley, where there's a lot of this mad science going on, and his team gave 70 and 20-year-olds a memory test. The participants were trained to match 120 common words, for example, bird, with nonsense words made of combinations of random syllables like jubu. They were teaching them some gibberish language. Once they learned the word nonsense word combos, the volunteers played a version of the game called memory, and they had to match the word pairs twice, once about 10 minutes after they mastered the task, and again a few hours after waking from a full night's rest. While they slept, researchers recorded the electrical activity in their brains, and I'm going to guess they put an EEG on them. And as expected, the older adults' ability to remember the word pairs in the morning was worse than their counterparts in the younger group, and the electrical recordings revealed one reason. Two kinds of brain waves, slow oscillations, large undulations that promote restorative sleep, and that would probably be in the lower frequencies like the 10 megahertz and below, or 10 hertz and below, we looked at before. Two kinds of brain waves, slow oscillations, low, large undulations that promote restorative sleep and sleep spindles, which are transient bursts of short waves, are the telltale marks of deep, typically dreamless, non-rapid eye movement sleep. But these waves are out of sync in older people, which was research that was reported today in Neuron. This out-of-step activity, they say, interrupts communication between parts of our brain that store short-term and long-term memories. And in effect, Heffleck says, the prefrontal cortex, and that is the part of the brain that is affected by our usage of connected devices, where the long-term memories are stored, needs to tell the hippocampus, which is the part of the brain where all the memories go first, that it is ready to receive the information. And if the brains aren't in sync, the communication gets lost, and so do the memories. Well, that's pretty frightening that it starts in the prefrontal cortex, because that part of the brain, it seemed to me to come up a lot in a lot of these things where damage is being done by being online and by interacting with feedback loops and that dopamine button. But to figure out what causes this asynchrony, the researchers looked at a participant's brain using structural magnetic resonance imaging, which uses radio waves to view internal organs. They found the part of the brain that makes slow oscillations and long-term memories, and it was smaller in older participants, suggesting that older adults are more forgetful because this region atrophies over time. The atrophy is enough to impair the mechanism to bring the brainwaves together in time to really store memories overnight. But Emery Brown, a neuroscientist at MIT's Technology Institute in Cambridge, is skeptical. He calls this a bit of a stretch to draw such conclusions based on brain scans. He would like to see the results reproduced in other settings first. Still, Phil Azee, a neurologist and neuroscientist at Northwestern University in Chicago, says that the research connects a lot of dots between sleep and memory. She is curious whether the results will hold up in adults who are at risk for neurological conditions such as Alzheimer's. And you got to wonder if maybe being sleep-deprived at some point causes some of that. Eliseos Carigirio, a neurologist and neuroscientist at the University of San Francisco, would add another layer of analysis. For example, if researchers didn't know those memory results that they were looking at, they could have predicted maybe these unsynchronized brainwaves. Well, he agrees that the findings could potentially lead to memory loss therapies and optimizing the timing of these brainwaves with electrical or magnetic stimulation, for example, could be one way to improve people's memories. All right. So bringing us back into sync, maybe with a few zippity zaps might help that, and that might be a therapy in the future. Talking about therapies in the future and some of the questions that they have about our brains, this is out of Medical News Today from a few days ago, December 12th, 2017. We all hear voices in our head, but why? Well, the study investigates. The brain treats talking inside of our heads, and that would be the speech center. And this is what I found interesting about this is the speech center is where Facebook is targeting, according to Regina Duggan, to be able to create some sort of thought typing interface to Facebook as well as potentially other applications. The brain treats talking inside of our heads is essentially the same thing as talking out loud, according to new research published in the journal eLife, which may help explain conditions such as schizophrenia. Now, notice how they are making all of these little dotted lines to all these diseases of the mind, ding, 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 because someday they want to be able to diagnose all of us with some sort of mental disease on a spectrum. I'm telling you, it's going to happen, especially when they start doing things such as voice diagnostics. And then they're going to use you as a guinea pig to be able to fix some of your problems, not invasively, of course. We spend a lot of time listening to ourselves talk inside of our own heads, and we listen to our inner voice each time we read a book, decide what we have for lunch, or imagine how we are going to get our views across in a meeting. In fact, estimates suggest that we spend at least a quarter of our waking hours attending to that inner voice and having conversations. But how is the brain able to tell the difference between the inner voice and the external ones that make the sounds that other people hear? Well, tools exploring this area of brain processing could be very useful to improving your understanding of disorders that involve hearing voices, such as schizophrenia, which also happens to be the same disorder that they are targeting some of those new smart pills to be able to track whether or not you've taken your medication. Schizophrenia and hallucinations. Schizophrenia is a long-term, severe, disabling mental illness that affects around 1.1% of adults in the United States, and in most cases, symptoms start in late adolescence or in earlier adulthood. The disorder disrupts thinking, emotions, perceptions, and behavior, making it hard to get along with people, hard to keep a job, and manage day-to-day life, and experts suggest that this highly complex disease is probably a collection of several disorders. A common symptom of schizophrenia is auditory verbal hallucinations. We're going to look at auditory verbal hallucinations and some scientific ways that they can induce those as well, or hearing voices that other people do not hear. For some time, it has been assumed that these hallucinations are a result of the problems with inner speech, but this study explains first author Thomas Whitfield, an associate professor in the School of Psychology at the University of New South Wales in Australia, provides the tools for investigating this once untestable assumption. When we speak our thoughts out loud, our brain sends our instructions that tell the vocal cords, tongue, and lips how to move to produce the intended sounds. And when that happens, the brain also makes copies of those instructions. This is known as the efferent copy. The efferent copy allows the brain regions to process sound to predict what they are about to receive. And if the efferent copy matches the sound that we actually hear when we speak, then the sound processing response is more subdued. The efferent copy dampens the brain's response to self-generated vocalizations. I don't really understand what that means. He explains that this effect with another example. Try to tickle yourself, and it feels much less ticklish than when someone else does it. When we try to tickle ourselves, the brain produces an efferent copy of the instruction to its fingers, allowing it to predict the exact sensation, resulting in a somewhat dampened response. But if someone else does the tickling, there is no reference copy, and the unpredicted act, even if it involves the same sensations, creates a bigger response in the brain and the feeling of being tickled. So the purpose of this new study was to find out whether or not the brain makes an efferent copy for inner speech the same way it does for words that are spoken out loud. And the team recruited 42 healthy volunteers to use EEGs to track their brain activity as they listened to vocal speech on headphones. Now, if you had your new technology from Facebook wearing your little EEG and watching a Facebook video, let's say, for example, they could be reading your EEG while you are listening to vocal speech in your headphones. Just saying, I thought that was kind of interesting as well. And as the test participants listened, They had to make either the same or a different sound in their heads to the sounds that they heard. The EEG recordings showed that a specific type of brain response was dampened when the inner speech sound was the same as the external one. However, when the inner speech sound did not match the external one, the dampening did not occur and the response was much bigger. The researchers conclude that this indicates that the brain makes an efference copy for inner speech the same way it does for external speech. And they suggest that the method they used in the study could also be useful for exploring what happens in the brain during an auditory verbal hallucination. All right, now talking of auditory hallucinations, there was a story that came out, I think it was in 2012. Well, there was one in 2012. This one is from 2007 out of Wired.com. The voice of God weapon returns. And remember, we've talked about this one before. This is utilizing that sonic part of the microwave frequencies to be able to beam voices into insurgents' heads to make them think that they are hearing Allah. The voice of God weapon, which is a device that projects voices into your head to make you think that God is speaking to you, is the military's equivalent of an urban myth. Meaning it is mentioned periodically in defense workshops. Ironically, the first that I, the author, Sharon Weidenberger, heard about it was at the same defense conference where she met Noah, and I don't know who Noah is, she'll mention him later. And typically someone whispers about it actually being used. And now Stephen Corman, writing at the ComOps Journal, describes his encounter with this urban myth. So Stephen Corman says, at a government workshop some time ago, I heard someone describe a new tool that was described as the voice of Allah. This was said to be a device that would operate at a distance and would deliver a message that only a single person could hear. The story was that it was tested in a conflict situation in Iraq and pointed at one insurgent in a group who whipped around looking in all directions and began a heated conversation with his compatriots who did not hear the message. At the time, I greeted this story with some skepticism. Well, is there a basis to this technology? Well, Holosonic Research Labs and American Technology Corporation, could that be a more generic name for you not to be able to find them on Google? Both have versions of directed sound, which can allow a single person to hear a message that others around them don't hear. DARPA appears to be working on its own sonic projector. Intriguingly, Strategy Page reports that troops are using the long-range acoustical device, more affectionately known as LRAD, is a modified voice of God weapon. Quote, it appears that some of the troops in Iraq are using quote-unquote spoken as opposed to screeching LRAD to mess with enemy fighters. Islamic terrorists tend to be superstitious and, of course, very religious, and LRADs can put the word of God into their heads. If God, in the form of a voice that only you can hear, tells you to surrender or run away, what are you going to do? Well, as Corman also notes, CNET recently wrote about an advertisement in New York for A&E's new TV show called Paranormal State, which uses some of the same technology. Beyond directed sound, it has been known that microwaves at certain frequencies, ding, 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 a technology that we are surrounded by, as a matter of fact, by cell towers, that would be microwaves, can produce an auditory effect that sounds like it is coming from within someone's head. And then there is the nagging question of classified microwave work at the Brooks Air Force Base that the Air Force stubbornly refuses to talk about. That brings us back to the voice of God, Allah weapon. Is it real or is it bogus? Well, in one version related to me by another defense reporter, it is not just Allah's voice, but it is an entire holographic image projected above them. Who decides what Allah looks like? And remember, we talked about that Project Bluebeam a long time ago. I still haven't seen any real evidence for that. But I could tell you with some of the things that they are working on now, I don't doubt that they would be able to do something like that. Well, does it exist? Well, this author says, I am not sure, but it is funny that when you hear brought up at defense conferences, no one ever asks the obvious question, does anyone think that this thing will actually convince people that God is speaking to them? And this author says, I am thinking not. But, you know, it makes you wonder all this research going into the brain and research going into how to manipulate neurons and change behaviors and do things of that nature, who's to say that they couldn't be working on something like that that they could use to change people's minds or flip ideas so you're not upset anymore, you're not angry, everything is going to be okay. Well, you got to just look at some of the research that has been going on. And one of the projects that Dr. Boyden was working on was a project called Microns. And this is, Micron stands for Machine Intelligence from Cortical Networks. It is being funded by IARPA, which is the DARPA of the intelligence agencies. This is known as the Apollo Project of the Brain. Microns is seeking to revolutionize machine learning by reverse engineering the algorithms of the brain. The program is expressly designed as a dialogue between data science and neuroscience. Participants in the program will have the unique opportunity to pose biological questions with the greatest potential to advance theories of neural computation and obtain answers through carefully planned experimentation, ding, 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 and data analysis. Over the course of the program, participants will be improving their understanding of the representations, transformations, and learning rules employed by the brain to create ever more capable, neurally derived machine learning algorithms. Ultimate computational goals for Microns include the ability to perform complex information processing, such as one-shot learning, unsupervised clustering, scene parsing, and aiming toward human proficiency. So we got intelligence agencies tinkering around with brains. We have mini brain balls and all kinds of different labs. We have them experimenting with different wavelengths in the microwave frequency. We saw some of the flashes of light with optogenetics and transcranial stimulation and some of those other ones. Where we go, guys. There were a couple patents that we ran across the other day in some of our research and looking into things such as 5G that I found pretty curious, and I wanted to share with you. This is one dated, filing date October 31st, 1997, titled Subliminal Acoustic Manipulation of Nervous Systems. Now, not only is it acoustic manipulation, but it is subliminal acoustic manipulation. In human subjects, sensory resonances can be excited by subliminal atmospheric acoustical pulses that are tuned to resonant frequencies. The half-hertz sensory resonant effects of the autonomic nervous system may cause relaxation, drowsiness, excitement, depending on precise acoustical frequencies near half a hertz that are used. The effects of the 2.5 hertz resonance includes slowing of certain cortical processes, sleepiness, and disorientation. For these effects to occur, the acoustical intensity must lie in a certain deeply subliminal range. Suitable apparatus consists of a portable battery-powered source of a weak sub-audio acoustical radiation. The method and apparatus can be used by the general public as an aid for relaxation, sleep, or arousal in clinical control, perhaps for the treatment of insomnia, tremors, epileptic seizures, or anxiety disorders. Yeah, go back to sleep. There is further application as a non-lethal weapon that can be used in law enforcement standoff situations for causing drowsiness and disorientation of targeted subjects. And then there is a preferable to use venting acoustic monopoles in the form of a device that inhales and exhales with air for sub-audio frequencies. And I just wanted to look one second if this is the one with the fan. Yeah, they give diagrams in regards to this, and there is literally a fan that is sucking air through it and blowing the air toward the individual with a little power supply and this little generator for frequency. And it made me wonder, there was an auditory thing that was documented one time that another friend and I had looked into, and how you could sometimes hear voices from a fan. And that is an auditory thing that they've known about for a very long time, but it has to do with that whole inhale and exhaling of air. So now here's another patent that we also ran across, and the diagram is what got me. Nervous system manipulation by electromagnetic fields from monitors. Now, monitors such as the one you sit in front of when you're in front of your devices. physiological effects have been observed. Oh, this is dated 2001 for the filing date for this patent. Psychological effects have been observed in human subjects in response to stimulation of the skin with weak electromagnetic fields that are pulsed within certain frequencies near half hertz or 2.4 hertz, such as to excite a sensory resonance. Many computer monitors and TV tubes, so that were like old school monitors, when displaying pulsed images, emit pulsed electromagnetic fields in sufficient amplitudes to cause such excitation. It is there possible to manipulate the nervous system of a subject by pulsing images displayed on a nearby computer monitor or TV set. What? Oh, yes. And for the latter, the image pushing may be embedded in the programming material or may be overlaid by modulating a video stream, either as RF signals or as a video signal. The image displayed on a computer monitor may be pulsed effectively in a simple computer program. And for certain monitors, pulsed electrical magnetic fields capable of exciting sensory resonances in nearby subjects may be generated even as the image is displayed and pulsed with subliminal intensity. Guys, we always worried about the television. Well, here you have it. The invention relates to the stimulation of the human nervous system by an electromagnetic field applied externally to the body, and that was probably utilizing the tubes. But why couldn't they do that with some sort of power line or some sort of wireless connectivity? Because that is all within the electromagnetic spectrum. The neurological effect of external electrical fields has been mentioned by Wiener in 1958, ding, 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 older studies, in a discussion of bunching of brainwaves through nonlinear interactions. The electric field was arranged to provide a, quote, direct electrical driving of the brain, unquote. And Wiener describes the fields as set up by a 10 hertz alternating voltage of 400 volts applied in a room between the ceiling and the ground. 10 hertz is within those brainwaves. Brennan in 1992 describes in a U.S. patent an apparatus for alleviating disruptions in your circadian rhythm of mammals in which an alternating electric current is applied across the head of a subject by two electrodes placed a short distance from the skin. The device involving a field electrode as well as a contact electrode is the Gram potentializer mentioned by Hutchinson in 1991. And this relaxation device uses motion, light, and sound as well as an alternating electrical field applied mainly to the head. The contact electrodes is a metal bar in the ohmic contact with the bare feet of the subject. And blah, blah, blah. They can be applied.